this morning. I need to get the number of letters and staff coming to the floor. Lydia Bouchelle received her undergraduate degree from Cornell University and received her law degree from Loyola and is in practice in the state of Illinois. Jason Callahan, undergraduate from Washington and Lee, and is law firm.
They're supposed to be spineless, though, and I don't think Ann is.
Oh, we're very happy to have you as members of our court. Your motion is granted, and if you step to the clerk's desk, we'll administer the oath. Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick.
Or they all volunteered, so. Something.
Okay, our case for argument this morning, Thomas versus Simpson and Syback. Ms. Price. The court allotted 30 minutes to a side, but you shouldn't feel obligated to take all the time. It's not that complicated a case. So.
Let me tell you what worries me about that. It is that anybody who gave a notice that was actually verbatim, the notice that's supposed to come with an initial communication, would be engaged in misleading communications. Because it says, I'll wait 30 days to see what you do, and if you complain, I'll do nothing, when the rules for litigation may call for an answer in less than 30 days. And it may call for, indeed require, the plaintiff to do something in response to an answer. So how would it be accurate, not misleading, since the Act is supposed to avoid misleading things, to notify the debtor that this time schedule, the 30-day time schedule, and then do nothing, would apply in lieu of the time schedule for the court in which the case is pending? Seems like a clear conflict. If the lawsuit is filed in federal court, you have 20 days to answer the complaint. So if you send a notice saying you've got 30 days to dispute, if you dispute, I'll do nothing, somebody relies on that notice and doesn't answer the complaint in 20 days, they'll be subject to a default judgment. That would be fraud, one might think. Yeah, but I don't understand that. Suppose the defendant answers the complaint in 20 days or says, I'd like a more definite statement. And the judge, acting under Rule 12E, says, yes, I'd order the plaintiff to file a more definite statement. On the one hand, the plaintiff's lawyer has just said, I will do nothing. I will stop if you make this request in 30 days. And on the other hand, the judge has said, you've got 10 days to file a more definite statement. Are these things compatible? Yes.
Who moves for a default judgment, though? Who? Right, the plaintiff. Right?
I don't understand. Why do you think the lawyer can move for a judgment in 20 days and extinguish the 30-day verification period? I mean, I thought that was your complaint, that this is jumping the gun. This is bypassing the 30-day requirement by filing a lawsuit instead of sending a letter.
And I thought you were saying that if the lawyer wants to file the lawsuit, the lawyer can wait until the 30th day to move for default judgment. Nobody says that if you fail to move on day 20, you've waived the right forever to do that. Well, aren't there cases, in fact, in district courts where the summons, complaint, and the notice have all come together in a package? Right. It's not. Let me try and clarify something here. You're not arguing that the filing of the summons and complaint were the initial communication. You're really arguing that service of the summons and complaint were the initial communication.
That's correct.
Okay.
Are there any other situations where a lawyer, in filing a lawsuit, a summons and complaint, must include in the summons and complaint anything remotely similar to what you say has to be included in a fair debt collection action? Then you get all kinds of arguments about it being overshadowed and confusing and send mixed signals, as Easter points out on the 20 days and 30 days.
Now, are there any other instances in which summons and complaints have bold-faced language? We are a debt collector trying to collect a debt?
Yes. So the ad is very
bold. Well, I'm just saying that this particular summons and complaint already reflected the fact that there was an overlay between the debt collector function, since the Supreme Court held in Hines that there is a debt collector function for lawyers. And these people announced quite clearly and appropriately that they were debt collectors. They weren't just regular lawyers that GMAC had hired to file a lawsuit on the creditor's behalf. Suppose they had just filed the lawsuit, though. Surely GMAC, a creditor, can hire a lawyer or even use an inside counsel to file a lawsuit to collect on a debt. It's one of the oldest kinds of lawsuits there is. And so why is this different? Are we arguing about a lot of form? What if they had omitted that statement about being a debt collector?
Well, how, suppose you hire a law firm that occasionally collects debts. How does that fit in? Well, how do we know if it falls within the definition, if they occasionally collect debts on behalf of clients?
Are there regulations that define what regular means?
But a cautious law firm that says, maybe a sizable law firm that has a number of cases going on at the same time, even though they don't consider themselves debt collectors, they may be pursuing it. Wouldn't you be concerned about having to comply with the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act?
I would if I were that.
But it's clear that you can be, after Hines, it's clear that litigation is one of the ways you can be a debt collector for purposes of this statute.
The purpose of the act is to curb abusive debt collection practices. Ever been a situation where resorting to state court legal proceedings and judged to be an abusive practice?
Ms. Price, what deference do you think we owe the FTC staff commentary? And given the fact that the FTC took a contrary position to the 2000 advisory position, doesn't it make Vega's logic questionable? What, if anything, are we to make of the fact that there's legislation pending in Congress that would move in the direction of the 11th Circuit's approach?
Okay, thank you, Ms. Price. Mr. Monahan?
Is that your only position? Let me ask you a question parallel to the one I asked the amicus. Have you ever argued in this case that if your client, if this pleading is an initial communication, that the language of the notice has to be modified to conform to the time requirements in the litigation? So your only argument is that it's just not covered by the Act, period?
That's the only
specified. I'm not asking what was the only issue reached. I was asking what your argument was.
Okay.
Thus far?
Well, the trouble you face is this: the language of the statute is extraordinarily broad. Conveying of information through any medium? Well, the courts are a medium. Right. Yeah. So? Well, forget McKnight. So you have this very strong language, and will the sky really fall if the language is applied the way it's written? What will happen? What horrors will occur if you have to, you know, send them their letter within given their 30 days interval to demand verification of the debt? Forget the McKnight case. Look, I'm asking you a question. Usually, if we have extraordinary explicit statutory language, we sometimes will override it. If the result is going to be, you know, really absurd, really contrary to the legislative design. So what are the really bad effects that would follow from applying the statute as it's written, if any? No, you're not following me. What will be the bad consequences if we hold that the summons is within the reach of the statute?
Why? Why can't another communication, why can't there just be a letter clarifying the situation be sent to the debtor?
Well, I don't understand. Well, what Judge Williams is saying is, why don't you just send the debtor the letter?
And what would be the problem if the letter happened to arrive a day or two before the summons and complaint? It just means the 30-day period would start running a little sooner, which actually leads me to another.
Why doesn't it arrive 30 days or 60 days before the complaint?
Well, that's right. Your position
complies fully with both the state rules and the federal rules. If 60 days before you initiate the lawsuit, you send the 1692G letter, right?
That's correct.
Any problem?
No.
Well, then why don't we harmonize the state practice and the federal statute by saying, look, what lawyers have to do, they can comply with both by sending the federal notice 60 days before they file their state lawsuit.
And the virtue of that approach is, on top of that, instead of creating an incentive in the statutory structure to rush off and litigate before you've given the validation period, you actually very nicely accommodate the purposes of both regimes.
No one is obligated, but... If the problem is that complying with the federal act at the very time you file the complaint is going to cause difficulties, practical difficulties, those practical difficulties can be alleviated. Now, if the lawyer wants to bring them on himself, he can send the notice with or within 5 days after the complaint. If a lawyer wants to avoid them, he can send the notice earlier. It's not a legal requirement that it be done. But if you can't explain why the state practice and the federal law cannot be harmonized in this way, it seems to me you don't have a practical objection to the application of the statute.
Yes, the rule of law.
Well, you're saying that that would have to be the rule, but I thought we'd already established that if service of process was the initial communication, and that's the time when the notice went out, it would be possible to forbear from filing a motion for a default judgment for 10 days. It would be possible to seek court permission to contact the debtor in various ways. The state procedures, like the federal procedures, allow for a certain amount of flexibility at that early stage of litigation. So as Judge Easterbrook says, if you really want to do it the hard way, you can do it the hard way and let it all work. But if you want to do it the easy way, a ready option is available. And I would add, an option is available if you're not sure if you're a debt collector or not. Maybe the easy thing to do is just send a notice and then litigate the way you would ordinarily litigate.
Do you see this as a way that the rules of practice are changed without actually going through the normal procedures that we employ to change the practice rules?
So in other words, you really want to use these state procedures to defeat the 30-day verification right that debtors have. But you take away their federal right, this 30-day verification right.
But that's very rare, isn't it? I mean, really, we're talking about the sky's falling here. The sky isn't going to fall regardless of what we do in this case, on this issue. But isn't it true that most of the time when a case comes to a lawyer, the initial correspondence with the debtor, compliance with the Fair Debt Collection Act, has already happened? Yeah.
Well, not in this case. Well, that's very common, yeah, but the creditor to deal directly, but that's not compliance with the debt collector statute.
No.
Well, that's your whole argument. You can circumvent the debt collection, the federal statute, by jumping in with a lawsuit before you have any correspondence with the debtor. That's your basic argument.
You're saying that you can avoid the duty to inform debtors of the validation right simply by filing the lawsuit, and isn't that really troublesome since many debtors don't have the money to hire attorneys? So your answer is yes, that debt collectors can avoid their duty under 1692G by simply serving the lawsuit and filing the lawsuit.
That's kind of like a reverse preemption you're arguing for, that in your view, despite both the breadth of the definition of communications in the FDCPA and the Supreme Court's decision in Hines saying that the statute applies to lawyers who, through litigation, try to collect debts, nonetheless, state procedures preempt the federal statute.
No.
But you have no language, do you? You have no language in the FDCPA that exempts regular litigation activities, which could have been exempted for all of the reasons you're saying. Obviously, litigation operates under a different set of rules, but where's the statutory hook?
So far all you've argued is that it isn't necessary to apply the federal statute here because of various requirements that state law imposes on litigation. So that's fine, but you haven't argued that there's any real problem in requiring both compliance with state procedural law and the federal statute. I thought you were going to argue that somehow it would put lawyers in a difficult position if they had to comply with both. You're not arguing that, are you? How so? Concretely.
But that you didn't answer why they couldn't just happen in different places, why the service couldn't comply with state law while the FDCPA, while the delivery of the FDCPA notice complied with federal law. Why did they have to be in the same package? There's no way this can be explained in the letter. Right.
The letter would explain to the, if you wanted to send a letter with the service of the summons and complaint, you could explain what the rights are there. The fact that there are two documents, one that he may get at work and one that he gets at home, I mean, you don't think a lawyer could craft a letter that would be clear? Yeah, I mean clear to an unsophisticated debtor, so lawyers can't write in simple language. I know it's a big challenge, but I think that lawyers can write in simple language.
Is your position that this act is somehow improperly infringing upon the state's ability to control their own litigation process?
I want to clarify one thing in your position. Is your position that if, as in this case, the creditor is sent out the collection letters and everything else, then they transfer the file to the attorney to file suit. That it's your position, then you should be able to file that lawsuit, given whatever package you've given from your client, to sue for the obligation. On the other hand, if you got that file and sent out a preliminary letter, you would have to comply with the statute of putting all the right information in it. Please, I'm trying to make a distinction. One, on the one hand, you file the suit right away. On the other hand, you then send a letter making a demand that you either pay or else I'm going to sue. Then you would have to put all of the information in that letter, would you not? Okay. What I have a problem here is that while I may accept the first part and the provision, the second part, in the middle comes this declaration in the complaint that you're a debt collector and putting it out in sort of bold type that would not be a necessary inclusion normally if you got the file from the client and then filed a lawsuit. You wouldn't say, I'm a debt collector, but for some reason you've identified yourself as one, and now it puts it into what I consider at least a gray area in this particular fact situation.
Well, why did you do it?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well,
what does that mean, excessive cost?
Shouldn't we hold you to that admission now?
What was your thinking? I don't understand excessive cost. What were you worried about? Why did you do it? What did you think you were gaining? But so what? Your clients have, maybe they have pink eyelashes or something. Well, you don't put a description of your client in a summons. So why'd you do it this time? And so what? It has no relevance on your view of the case.
If the law firm didn't believe it was subject to the FDCPA, why in the world would it say it was on the face of the complaint? But they are conceding, you've already said that they're subject to the FDCPA for everything they do after the service of the summons and complaint under Hines, which was your distinction of that opinion. So, you know, it's a little difficult to see why you exempt that one act if it happens to be the initial communication. But you said they were subject to the statute, and Dunning letters and all sorts of other things could happen that they would be answerable to.
Wouldn't your overshadowing problem be solved if you sent the letter more than 30 days before you sued?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So after 30 days, if the debtor hasn't requested verification, then you'd bring your lawsuit.
Correct.
There wouldn't be any overshadowing problem there, would there? Well, you get verification and, you know, you notify the debtor, and then you say, okay, we verified the debt, now we're going to sue you if you don't pay it. You wanted verification? Got verification. Now pay. If you don't pay, we sue you. There's no overshadowing problem in that. You lose a few days, you lose a few weeks, right? That's all we're talking about, isn't it? You lose a few weeks if you have to send a letter. Okay. That's the stakes in this case. Right. Right, precisely. First. Right.
So is that the observed result that you've argued?
But you certainly would agree that there's no interference with state court procedures if you simply sent the letter 30 days in advance. The state courts can do whatever they want to with the lawsuit once it's properly filed. Unless we go, it's taken back to a point that Judge Posner made earlier, which is the question whether, in fact, what you're trying to do is take advantage of these short notice replevant actions and defeat the 30-day verification period that the debtor is given under the federal statute. If you can do an end run around that 30 days and zip in and get your replevant action, then obviously I can see the strategic advantage for the creditor and the debt collector. They do for all creditors, though. They do for the rest of the creditors who are subject to this statute, who comply with the rules. Those state statutes aren't limited to the set of odd facts that we have here.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Monahan. Your time has expired. Mr. Dubno?
I just have one tiny little fact question. Was GC Services involved in the collection of the debt?
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dubna. Ms. Price, how much time does she have?
14 minutes. No. I think you'll need to use all of it, too.
Want to say anything about GMAC?
I want to ask just this one question, same one before, and that is, it would be your position that even if the creditor did all the preliminary correspondence and demands and everything, decided that this person isn't going to pay or whatever, then turns over to their lawyer this file in order to file suit. If the lawyer does nothing other than file the lawsuit, and I might add does not include a declaration in there, some reason that they're debt collector and other things, you would still say that would be a preliminary communication. Well, he's a lawyer and you've got a client, and the other thing is, you know, I realize how long it's been since I've been a practitioner and made letters, but there were times when I would collect debts other than commercial, which I understand is an exception here, that it would, you would send a demand letter. It may be something that you know, you have to do. And then if someone says file a suit, gives you the file, then you can file the suit. Sometimes, you know, contracts and things are long statutes of limitations. Sometimes you got to get it on file before that time expires when you get the file. So I'm just saying you still maintain that no matter what, that's the initial communication.
Well, if the factual question, I thought you were saying, though, that the preliminary factual question of statutory coverage was whether the lawyer regularly collects or attempts to collect the debt. So that question has to be resolved, perhaps, I don't know, it's a coverage question.
I regularly do it when my client asks me to, which isn't very often.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Price, for serving as an attorney, and thank you to lawyers for the defendants also, and the case will be taken under advisement, court will be in recess.